Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Turned Into Punk Classics, a show where we take old episodes of Turned Into Punk that have been lost from the internet and return them to their previous glory by sticking them back on the feed. You can find this podcast on YouTube, TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, and all other forms of social media. Well, that's pretty much it. At Turned Into Punk, you can find me on Twitter or Instagram at LeftForDamian. I play in a band. More information can be found at fuckedup.cc. Now sit back, relax, and enjoy another TOAP classic. Laura, thank you so much for sitting down and talking to me. We also have Melanie, Isabella, and Eric in the room as well. But
happy to be here.
No, it means a lot having us in your hotel room before a show. Because God knows mine wouldn't be any state to do this. So I really appreciate you having us here.
I like to think I kind of excel in the art of, like, breaking in a hotel room when I get into it. I'm just like, huzzah, I'm throwing everything everywhere.
Not to throw dispersions on the room, but no, this isn't broken in at all compared to what I do.
We got in late last night.
Okay, that's good. Okay, so you got some more time. But thank you so much for coming on the show. You're someone that I've wanted to talk to for a long time because I think watching Against Me's ascent, being in our band, it was kind of like, a lot of stuff that I think we went through a little bit later, as far as labels and as far as growing up as a band that went from being a DIY band to becoming a band on a bigger platform.
Right.
I was just always like, just, you know, living vicariously through you and then going through the same struggles of those early band stages too. So I think I can't wait to get into this.
That's awesome. I totally recognize the same in watching you all like, from a distance, too.
Yeah, so
I'm a big fan of you.
Oh, well, this is awesome. Then let's not. I don't want to waste any more time with it by taking up me yammering. How did you get into punk? Like, do you remember the first time you heard it?
You know, it was really kind of, like, gradual where, like, I... like, when I was young, like elementary school, mm-hmm. I just kind of listened to whatever and would buy cassette tapes based on whether or not I liked the cover.
Yeah.
So, like, my first cassette tape I ever got was Def Leppard Hysteria.
Yeah.
And then, like, you know, I used to read, like, Hit Parade or Magazine, and, like, there were some of those bands from back then, like Guns N' Roses in particular, who were one of my favorite bands, who would wear punk band shirts. Mm-hmm. You know, like, they'd wear a damn shirt. Or I wore a Sid collar because Duff McKagan wore a Sid collar when I was, like, 8 or 9 years old. And I remember seeing, like, Sex Pistols spray painted on a wall probably when I was like 9 years old, and this was in Italy at the time. But I probably didn't like hear the Sex Pistols until I was probably 12 or 13, and it was like, you know, I was into those bands then kind of did the whole like early middle school into classic rock, like mm-hmm. The Doors, Led Zeppelin, The Beatles, and Pink Floyd, and like my scene of friends then at the time were really you know, like, the look went along with that, like, long hair and you know, wore, like, Grateful Dead shirts and stuff. But we got beat up a lot. So, like, around 8th grade, me and my best friend Dustin at the time, like, I remember us having, like, a conversation even about it being like, you know what, I'm tired of getting beat up. Let's fight back. Even if we still get beat up, let's fight back, you know? This new school year, we're going to do that. And, like, it was at the same time then where, like, Green Day was really, like, blowing up. Like, Green Day was my first real concert that I went to aside from, like, a local band or something.
Who was
like
the opener on that?
It was a band called Wooden Horse. They were from Pensacola, Florida.
Okay.
They might have just done the Florida Days.
So this is, like, what year? Was this per Kerplunk era? Or...
No, this was 1994, just as, like, Dookie was really... Out. Like, it was before a Woodstock performance or whatever.
So it's still early on that...
Yeah, but Longview was out on MTV or whatever.
Yeah.
And at the time, like... You know, we were discovering Green Day, and then also, like, I got Nevermind the Bollocks, and, like, that was, like, I guess my first real punk record that I bought. But when Green Day started blowing up like that, that was when, like, Rancid hosted 120 Minutes, and there was just all those bands you realized were tied together that we just kind of started digesting, and, like, we watched Tim and Lars host 120 Minutes, and we were like, okay, X, like, you know, okay, the Anti-Nowhere League, okay, like, all these videos that they played where we just went out the next day and started buying records.
Yeah, so that was, like, kind of, like, the, I guess, like, Epitaph sort of stuff, or you went back immediately to kind of the older stuff, or?
It was a mix of both, like, as we were really getting into that, like, East Bay kind of punk scene with, like, Green Day, all the Epitaph bands and everything like that, like, we were, me and my friend, best friend at the time were, like, buying Sex Pistols records. He bought, like, the Clash records, like, and just kind of discovering what we liked. We got into the Dead Kennedys, like, and there was maybe, like, two or three other kids at our school, and James, who plays in my band, included in that, who just like were all kind of getting into stuff at the same time. So we just share records, you know.
And were you playing already?
I played in a band that mainly did like Nirvana and Pearl Jam covers.
As
I
was, one
like,
did at that time.
Yeah, when I was like 12, 13 years old. And then me and my friend Dustin and James, like, we all just started playing in punk bands together. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, there was no scene there in Naples, Florida at the time where, like, there was no one you could look to and be like, oh, well, there are the older punks and that's how they do it. It was just like, okay, let's start a punk band and your mom and dad will let us do shows at their house, so we'll do the show at their house.
Historically, are there any punk bands from Naples, like, even back in the day? I'm trying to think, like... any of the bands like on like incredibly late for the trend or any of those Florida
No, comps, you know, but... there was like a little bit of the residual goth scene.
Okay, yeah.
Because there was like a huge goth scene in like the Tampa area or whatever.
Yeah.
So like there was like a band called Purulent, I remember, from Naples, Florida, and there was like a zine called Demented Kids that it wasn't punk, but it still had the punk like
vibe
thing to it. Yeah. You know, they're doing a cut and paste zine or whatever. So like it started there, and there was one record store called Offbeat Music that was first in Naples and then Fort Myers, which was like the town half hour north.
I would stay in Fort Myers as a kid. My grandmother lived there.
Oh, right. Yeah. Everyone's grandmother either lived in Fort Myers or Naples. But so we would go to shows in Fort Myers because they would have like bands come through, like actual bands. Mm-hmm. So.
And I guess Florida did have, well, I don't know, I you know better than I would, but were there other, like in these other towns, or who are some of the local bands that would have been playing around then?
Well, St. Pete, like, at the time was a mecca, you know, like, because there was State Theater, which did shows, and there was Janice Landing, and then there was, like, some venues in Tampa that actual touring bands would come through, and there was a couple, like, local bands that were, like, big. Mm-hmm. There was this band, Carbomb Driver, that would play fairly often. There was James ended up joining a band called The Scamps, who were, like, the biggest punk band out of St. Pete to never leave St. Pete. They could, like... they like opened for the Subhumans, you know, which was like mind blowing when you're like 14 years old.
Do they have any records or anything? Or
they recorded like one thing that was like a CD and a cassette or whatever, but it's like it's hard to find. You know?
Discogs only.
But so like there was a scene, like a legitimate scene there, and there was bands like in the Miami Fort Lauderdale area. There was a real strong Christian hardcore scene.
Yeah,
and I really didn't want anything to do with that, but. Those were the shows you ended up playing because it's like, okay, well, there's like seven Christian hardcore bands playing at the church.
Yeah.
And they'll let us play. So, like, it's a scene we can go and be a part of, you know?
We were actually talking about this a little bit in the car on the drive up here. There was like this moment in the mid 90s, and it was almost post MXPX, where like the wall broke down and the scenes began to merge, like the Christian punk scene and the, I guess, secular punk scene or the normal punk scene? I don't know, the punk scene?
Well, no, it, you know, I remember specifically, like, there was a huge zine scene, too.
Yeah.
Like, everyone did a zine, myself included. And there was...
what was your zine called?
Misanthrope.
Awesome.
But there was one zine in particular, I forget the name of, that had, like, this drawing of, like, the scene in Fort Myers. And it was cool in a way that you don't see anymore, where there was, like... the one skinhead in the drawing, the one hardcore straight edge kid in the drawing, the one crust punk kid in the drawing, like, you know, like every aspect of like punk was represented in there, you know, like, and it was, you don't see that scene unity, and that's what they call, you know, that's what it was. It was unity.
I think it's because like you couldn't, especially like the 90s, you couldn't really afford to be bias on how restrictive your scene was, because there wasn't at least in Toronto, there weren't enough kids to be like, oh, here's the oi scene and here's the crust scene, and it's like, sorry, everyone's scene, because there's nowhere else to go for shows.
Right. Oh, going back also to like that we did play with MXPX at a church in Naples, Florida. So yeah, correct reference with MXPX.
But they were the band that everyone's like, they're not a Christian band. And everybody was like, no, they're definitely a Christian band. It was like the dividing line between me and my friends at one point of like MXPX. Were they or weren't they?
I'll say, though, that, you know, one band I always really enjoyed were 90 Pound Wuss.
Yeah.
They were rad. And I remember, like, that was at that show. It was like MXPX, 90 Pound Wuss, and like Shai Hulud, like a ton of like other bands or whatever. And I remember watching 90 Pound Wuss and being like, that was cool. Yeah. Like, they were good, yeah. You know?
Oh, there's, like, and I have a comp of, like, I guess this is before the breakdown in scenes, but I have an 82 Christian New Wave comp, and there are bands on it that sound like Screeching Weasel, but in, like, 1982.
Yeah.
It's, like, kind of awesome bands. Some of the subject matter's a little bizarre, but, yeah. You know? You started playing shows in punk bands. Do you remember the first band you were in, the name?
First band was called the Snot Rockets. Well, oh, no, it was first punk band was called Snot Rockets. Yeah.
What was that Nirvana band called?
We had two names. We were the Black, or Leather Dice and the Black Shadows. We could never, like, settle between the two.
Kind of sick names, though.
Good names, yeah. At the time, we thought they were really dorky, but then looking back, as I've grown older, I was like, those are kind of good. We should have stuck with
that. I could totally see Leather Dice putting out a record now on, like, the hip Buzz label.
Yeah, or playing Riot Fest.
Or playing Riot Fest. Yeah, Leather Dice is playing.
They're reuniting.
They're reuniting today. So, at which point did you start? I guess Against Me starts pretty soon after, right? Like, you're 17?
Yeah, I was. Well, so there was the Snot Rockets, which was me and my friend Dustin, and we kind of had a revolving cast of
drummers.
And
what did it sound like, kind of?
We sounded like, I mean, we did like 4 or 5 Rancid covers in our set, you know, like, and it'd be funny because you'd play shows at the other local bands and they would do 4 or 5 Rancid covers of the same songs in their set. But it was like a couple Rancid covers, a couple NoFX covers, and like our first attempts at trying to write our own songs, which weren't very good, but we're heavily influenced by those bands, obviously.
So you were a NoFX fan too?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. The first like 3 shows I ever saw were Green Day, then Rancid, then NoFX.
The big 3.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Offspring, I guess, would be the other one back then.
I never liked Offspring. I was like, eh.
Yeah, I can see that. I can definitely.
They played that all the time on MTV, and I was just like, nope, not interested.
It was a different vibe than Rancid and Green Day had.
Just the look didn't fit what I thought should be punk. Yeah. I mean, maybe that's fucked up to say, but it was like, this doesn't.
Well, you're a kid.
Braids? What is going on here? You know, like, I didn't understand the whole West Coast thing, you know, or like.
I was a huge fan of Bo Derek and 10, so I love the braids. I thought it was an awesome vibe, and I thought everything about that. I guess, like, sorry, after Snot Rockets, what was the next band you did?
Well, then the Snot Rockets turned into a band called Upper Crust, and then we heard that there, or no, for a second we were called Ginks, and then we turned into Upper Crust, and then we found out there was another band called Upper Crust who, like, dressed in, like, wigs and like, powdered faces.
Yeah, 17th century, like, garb.
So we were like, all right, we got to change their name. And then we became the Adversaries. And that was when it was, like, more like we actually played shows out of our city. We played, our, like, crowning achievement as a band probably was playing at the Hardback in Gainesville, Florida, which is, like, a mythical, legendary club there. But we played there right before it closed, and there was no one there except for Danarchy. And if you know who Danarchy is, you'll know that's cool. But, so that, like, lasted.
Not to interrupt you, but was Gainesville a mecca back then, too? Like, it would become?
It started slowly changing into that. At first, really, it was more like Tampa-St. Pete area. Mm-hmm. There was a store there called 403 Chaos that, like, had, like, a lot of good shows. And there was a lot of, like, the bigger venues in St. Pete where the bands would go to. And Gainesville, like, it was weird because, like, you know, we've always, as a band, kind of gotten associated with Hot Water Music. Mm-hmm. But, like, there was really no awareness, like, with me and my friends of Hot Water Music at the time until moving to Gainesville.
Mm-hmm.
And even then, it wasn't like we were listening. We just were like, oh, that's the band in town who tours a lot and who are really popular here. But so, you know, that band I was playing in kind of overlapped. The Adversaries, the ending of it was probably around 1996, 97, and overlapped with another grindcore band called Common Affliction that I played in for a second.
Did they do a record? Common? Did you guys?
No, there might have been another band called Common Affliction.
Yeah, okay,
We did like a tape. It was always cassette tapes because I had a 4-track cassette tape recorder, and you could dub them yourself and scam the copies from Kinko's, you know? But so like, The Adversaries was obviously dead, I knew, and Common Affliction, I could tell no one really wanted to do seriously. We just wanted to play once a week or something, get together and practice, and maybe play a show every couple months. So I started, like, I just did the first Against Me tape on a whim, you know, like, I was like, I set the goal of writing 10 songs, recorded it, dubbed 20 copies on a cassette tape, and gave them out to free for friends.
Mm-hmm.
And then that, like, then Common Affliction just, like, broke up, and so I was like, well, I guess I'll do Against Me.
Yeah, and so Against Me starts, and you, I guess there's the first tape?
Yeah, it was real small goals like that, where it was like, I just want to do a tape, and I did the tape, and then it was like, well, I want to play one show by myself, you know, because I was terrified of the idea of, like, being up there with an acoustic guitar and just me. So then I did that, and there was probably, like, maybe a year lag period where I was like, it's boring playing by yourself on an acoustic guitar. I want to play with the drummer. And it took about a year till I found my friend Kevin who could play. And then it kind of became more of a serious thing where we'd practice like 5 days a week and like wanted to tour and wanted to do stuff.
So where did the sort of acoustic influence and like the idea of like sort of the more, I guess, earnest song
right.
approach?
Well, there was like... You know, when I played in those other bands, I played bass.
Yeah.
And so I had like a Fender P bass and I had like a nice bass amp or whatever. But other than that, I didn't have an electric guitar. Mm-hmm. So when I was like, I want to do my own thing, I need a guitar, I have an acoustic, that's what I'm going to play. But at the same time, I was really like under the influence of a lot of like the peace punk bands, like Crass mm-hmm. is what I got into when I was like 14, 15 or whatever.
Yeah, Crass Records puts it, or Crass something puts up the tape, right?
Oh, well, Crass Hole, which Crass was like Hole. A, yeah, Baltimore thing. But so, like, there was the Crass scene of bands, which, you know, like, Crass Records, like,
yeah.
they did, like, Poison Girls, Omega yeah. Tribe, The Mob, Flux of Pink Indians, all those bands. But there were some other bands, like, there was this band, The Apostles, and The Apostles were fucking hippies, mm-hmm. totally hippies, you know? And they had, like, a lot of, like, acoustic-based songs and a lot of, like, old workers' songs. And then, like, I stumbled into this tape by this dude named Seth. So Seth was, like, in my opinion, the first person to do acoustic punk rock. Like, it was straight-up anarcho-punk on mm-hmm. an acoustic guitar. And it was, like, you know, that type of imagery on the cover where you could tell it was a crust person, like, and just, like, that was my influence where I was, like, I'll do that. Yeah, I want to do it exactly like that.
When's Seth from?
I don't, like, probably... 1996, 95, okay. 97 okay. era is when they were probably most active
yeah,
or whatever.
Yeah.
But, I mean, like, I never have since crossed paths or heard anything more. I still yeah. have two cassette tapes, but it was, like, that would, I think, was more associated with, like, the Profane Existence, Slug and Lettuce mm-hmm. type scene, like, mm-hmm. which then I started drifting into when I was, like, 16 years old or whatever. Mm-hmm. There was, like, a couple people who did, like, distros at shows where they'd sell 7 inches or whatever.
And Slug and Lettuce.
Yeah, and give out Slug and yeah. Lettuce zines or whatever. So, like, I was like, that's cool. Like, and I bought those records and then I was like, oh, anyone can do a distro. So, like, I started doing my own distro at shows and would order records wholesale from all those labels like Havoc and Profane Existence and then sell them at shows.
So that's more, I guess, the scene that you kind of came from, I guess, at a certain point? Is that because I knew there was, like, a lot of crust vibes, and I guess Profane Existence makes so much sense now that I hear that.
Totally, yeah. And well, like, you know, it was really detached from any greater, like, national or world crust scene or anything mm-hmm. or anything. Like, it was, you know, I discovered, like, Doom Records and Code 13 Records and Destroy Records and Civil Disobedience Records and everything, and, like, was like, oh, cool, that's awesome, you know? And I was really, like, getting more and more politically minded and politically active, and there was like an activist scene in Florida. So like me and a group of friends started doing Food Not Bombs down in our area, and there was a couple other cities in Florida that did Food Not Bombs, and then we all started organizing and meeting like once a month, and we basically would just get together, talk about how our Food Not Bombs were going and what success we were having. If there was any like other protests going on, we'd share the information, and then we'd play like kickball for 2 hours or something, you know, and like drink homebrew and sit around a fire. But then like we started getting more organized, and we became the Florida Radical Activist Network, and then we'd like organize rides to protests outside of the state and just try and like build an activist community in the state of Florida. Gainesville really came into the picture then because that's where the Civic Media Center is still, which is a non-corporate press volunteer-run library and activist space. So when I found out about that, I was like, that's where I want to move. I want to move to Gainesville and be a part of the CMC. So I did.
So was the first time you're kind of going out of state for more protest stuff and activist type
yeah,
stuff
totally.
Than less band stuff?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, the first time traveling out of state was definitely related to those things, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So at which point does the band, I guess, start picking up and become like where you're realizing this is going to be something, well, not mm-hmm. real, obviously that's a much longer evolution that we'll get to, but
right.
when's the point where you're like, this is something that people are engaged by or...
Well, I was fucking determined.
Yeah.
You know, like, because when we would first play shows, especially, like, when Against Me started out, I would sit down and play an acoustic guitar, and a drummer played on Buckets. You know, yeah. That was the setup. So you're playing these shows with other hardcore bands who are all standing up, doing flips, doing everything like that, you know, and you're like, and now here we are. So people would, like, make fun of us, you know.
Well, that's, like, the most radical thing you could do in that scenario.
But they would, like, heckle us, you know. Okay. No one got it. No one was into it. There was, like, maybe a couple people, but we didn't give a fuck. So, like, I just was, like, so set on, like, we can do this. We're going to be a revolutionary force, and we're going to change the world. And, like, that was our mentality. But so we, like, booked our first tour, which was, like, 1999. And I used Book Your Own Fucking Life, mm-hmm. and I wrote people letters, and I called numbers, you know, that weren't cell phones. And I, like, organized shows, and it was a month-long tour, and maybe 10 of those shows actually happened. And we spent, like, a month, like, sleeping at rest areas and going into Kentucky Fried Chickens and other fast food chains and begging for food, you know, yeah. like... That was the thing back then, is KFC would give you a meal if you went in and said, I'm hungry.
Really?
They'd give you a meal. And then you'd be like, but I'm vegetarian too, so no chicken. Like, I'm hungry, but not that hungry.
So just do the macaroni salad. Yeah,
please. But so we did that tour, and it was like, you know, we borrowed a friend's van to do it, mm-hmm. and, like, drove ourselves financially into the ground. Not that we had money at
Who
first.
Who were you playing with on this tour? Like I guess, because, like, you kind of... start the folk punk thing, you know, mm-hmm. in a big way against me. Well, like, I guess Planet X Records too, and but right. by extension. What type of bands and shows were these shows with?
Well, I remember the first show was in Gainesville, and it was whatever local Gainesville yeah. bands of the tour. And then we played, like, an open mic night in Atlanta, Georgia, that was, like, no one punk. But the third show on the tour we played was at this place called the Pink House
okay.
In Asheville, North Carolina. And I remember, like, it was terrible traffic driving from Atlanta to Asheville. And we get there, the show had already happened, but it was, like, 9 bands playing. So it was like, come on, you know, we're not, like, we didn't get a sound check anyways. But, like, we show up, and Aaron Comet Bus comes right out, and he's like, y'all are late. You can play 5 songs. And we were just, like, Whoa. Totally crushed. We're like, holy shit, that's Aaron Comet, that's Aaron Comet Bus, and he's angry with us right now. So, but I remember Shotwell played that band.
Okay.
Yeah. And that was, like, probably, like, the first, like, maybe legitimate, like, out-of-state Against Me show or whatever. Yeah. But then maybe the next show was, like, Baltimore, Maryland. And Baltimore, Maryland, that was where Crass Hole Records was. And Jordan, who, like, toured with the bands for years, or with my band for years, mm-hmm. like, there was a band called Apolitical that were a Baltimore band where Jordan was to Apolitical what he became to Against Me. Like, okay. he didn't play in the band, but he was a member of yeah. the band for yeah. all intents and purposes. But so I just became really friendly with them, and we became like it was obvious when we played there that people got it, and people were really excited about us. Mm-hmm. And Jordan was like, we'll put out a record for you, you know? And so that was like playing there and seeing that was like the first time where I was like, we can totally do this. Yeah. People will get it. You know, we yeah. just need to like stick at it. But there was like maybe, you know, a couple other shows on that tour where it was like, local bands, you know, all just local bands playing in basements everywhere you went or in a living room or whatever.
Was there better reception than you found playing back home?
Totally. Yeah. And especially like the second tour we did, which was like a year later in yeah. 2000, we went all the way out west, and like we did the whole west coast with that band Resist and Exist.
Okay. Yeah.
And like those shows are phenomenal, really great. So, and we just met more bands as we started going.
And I guess the West Coast is always like the, like talk about the mecca of all meccas for punk bands, like on the West Coast tour, like you hit the Bay Area and
yeah.
it's such a welcome kind of place.
Well, our Bay Area show got canceled, but we did play LA and that was cool. We did like Seattle and we did like Portland, and then San Francisco got canceled. But it was cool because it would be like, you know, you'd have a week in between shows. So we spent 1 week like camping in the woods of Montana. We wow. spent 1 week camping on the beach outside of Santa Cruz. And we just would go into whatever local town there was during the day, spare change money, buy beer, and then go back to wherever we were camping and hang out around a fire.
So I guess you finished that tour. Did you meet Var before that tour? Or I guess you would have met him.
No, we didn't meet Var. Like, we didn't even... So we did that tour, and then we did a third tour, and that was... our third tour was still before Reinventing Axl Rose, our first
record. So the 12-inch was out?
The 12-inch was out on the second tour.
On the second tour.
Yeah.
Okay.
And that was, like... There was a fuck-up with it where, like, I recorded it, I sent the tape to Jordan, and he thought... it was supposed to sound like he heard it, which was, there was a mastering error or whatever. And he's like, yeah, great. It's really crusty. Like, press it. And we were like so heartbroken when we got it. So we only sold like 150 copies on the road or whatever. And the rest of it just sat on eternally. And
wow.
It was only 500 pressed ever to begin with.
Well, that because there's a quote unquote second press. And that must be the second set of copies you
just
didn't
released.
Sell.
Yeah. But
it's like a $500 record.
Yeah, it goes for a lot. Yeah. But there's only 500 made.
Yeah.
Ever,
yeah.
You know, it's terrible. But some people will tell you it's the best thing we've ever done. So well, it's messed up, right?
Yeah, but that's like when you're in a band, once you put the record out there, there's no, unfortunately, you're like, no, but we're doing way better stuff now. Why can't you give this one a chance?
Right. But so we did like that. And then, but like, I could tell like that some people liked it, but that because of it was what it wasn't making the right connection or whatever. And then we recorded me and Kevin, the Crime 7-inch. And we had the Crime 7-inch, and I don't think we even had the Acoustic 7-inch, but just the Crime 7-inch we did our third tour on. And that was the first tour where, like, we were like, okay, well, we're selling a 7-inch, and we'll sell a t-shirt. And we sold the t-shirt for, like, $7 each, and the 7-inch was $3 each. But we came back from that tour, and we had made, like, maybe a couple $100s.
Yeah.
And that was the first time where it was like, holy shit. You know, hey, everyone, here's $100. You know, like... We're gonna do this.
Yeah,
totally. We're not totally broke. Like the band's destroyed, but we're not totally broke.
Yeah. So you hadn't like even met Var just at shows at this point, really?
No. Okay. Yeah. Well, he's, you know, Var's like kind of mysterious in that he's not like a big socialite or anything like that, or he wasn't like, he's not the person at the show crowd surfing or anything, being like, I'm Var from No Idea. Woo.
It's amazing going from No Idea to Fat Records just in the different
right.
The label heads.
Mm-hmm, totally. But so like we were aware of No Idea there, but like,
well, because it seems like, you know, like, you know, and I'm not to put your band in a corner, but you guys seemed like way more political than No Idea was at that time.
Totally. And we weren't liked in Gainesville at first. Like, no place would let us play. We only could play at the Civic Media Center, which wasn't really a venue. We would just be like, fuck it, we're playing here. And then, like, you know, the other thing about Gainesville, too, is that it was a really incestuous scene. Like, every single other Gainesville band or No Idea Records band, like, all the members have played with each other and other bands. So we were really virgin to that. Like, we had no overlap or anything. But so, like, once we wanted to do a full length, we didn't have the money to put it out ourselves, and we didn't know what we were going to do. So, like, we recorded it first, and Jordan paid for the recording. And originally, Ebullition Records was going to put out Reinventing Axl Rose.
Wow, really?
And then for a second, AF Records was going to put it out.
Whoa!
And then we finally, Jordan actually was the one who went into No Idea and was like, do you all want to put this out? Like, we still didn't, we had never met Var when he agreed to put out the record. And we had no control in going in there and asking.
You know?
It was just Jordan who went and made it happen, because Jordan paid for the recording.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator. What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
That is so... So did you, I guess... backing up, did you have a relationship with Ebullition? Like, had you gone and had a heart attack?
I loved Heart Attack. Yeah. You know, like, that was, like, I loved that zine, and I loved the label and records they put out, and we wanted them to put it out. But they were kind of, like, that was right when you could kind of tell maybe they were slowing down a little.
Yeah.
And, like, the zine was kind of, like, fizzling out or whatever. Mm-hmm. So, like, Kent ultimately passed, you know, and he since came back and was like, I really regret doing that. I wish I would have done that.
Changed the course of the DIY hardcore history right there. And I guess AF Records was Anti-Flag repping, like, against me at that point? Or?
Well, they did a comp that came with one of their records, and they put one of our songs on it.
That's where I think I first heard.
They put I Still Love You, Julie from the Crime 7-inch on there. But they were, like, really starting to ramp up their record label at the time or whatever. And, you know, we played Roboto Project in Pittsburgh, and they came out to the show, and we hung out a little bit, and they wanted to put out the record, but we ultimately passed.
Wow. And actually, I've heard about them coming to see you at that show from kids that were at that show being like, and then the guys from Anti-Flight came out to a show at the Roboto Project.
Well, people that whole show were like, they don't normally come out to shows. Like, it was weird, like, because they're just Anti-Flag, you know? Like, they're not, like, but they were, like, by the punks there, they were being treated as, like, A&R people, where we were all, like, we were afraid of them then, you know?
Well, like, it's when you're the local scene, you demonize the local band at a certain point, I guess.
Yeah, and totally, totally.
I remember when, like, Sum 41 would show up at a show, it's like the needle scratches off the record, like, what the hell are they doing at this show?
I just want to go to a show. Just think they play in a band.
It's like, now that I'm older, I'm just like, that was crazy. I was, like, insane as a younger person.
Yeah, well, it was different then.
Yeah.
It seemed to make sense.
It seems like it's important.
Yeah,
like, totally. It really seems like it mattered, and now you're like, hey, whoa. Anyways.
Well, you just see it different. You have perspective, you know, and you didn't have the same perspectives back then.
No.
But so we, like, ended up going with No Idea for that record, and then moved on to Fad after that.
So, you know, I should check. We're still good for time.
Oh, totally.
Let me know when we have to stop, because I will.
I was just thinking about the teabag story with Anti-Flag.
The teabag story? We did terrible, cruel things to Anti-Flag when we were on tour with them, but that's a whole other story, and that's like 5-6 years later after the fact.
So. Okay. Well, hopefully we won't get to that point in this episode of the podcast.
We were assholes. So.
I don't know what it meant.
So I guess we're So you signed to No Idea, and
they just put out the record.
But that was it immediate that record took off? Because it seems like I remember hearing about it pretty soon after it came out that it was like, it felt like it was bigger than like a big record coming out, you know?
Well,
like,
they had no perception of it, you know? Yeah. Like, their No Idea's perception of us was like that band in Gainesville that no one really liked.
Yeah.
No one wanted to see play. And, like, they didn't realize that we had already actually toured and that there were cities where people had heard about us and were really excited about us. So the record came out and it started doing really well just by underground word of mouth.
Yeah, was it Maximum Rock and Roll write about it?
Maximum Rock and Roll really championed us at first, and, like, there was just a lot
of Attack too, I think.
Yeah, gave really good, like, review. A lot of people, like, really just, like, were into the record, and we were just like, okay, now we can really tour. Let's go, you know?
Yeah. And so you start touring kind of immediately, and that record just seems like,
I'm getting it.
At that point, did you get, like, people like the rabid fan base begin forming? Because it just seems, I remember there's almost like, and this relates, you know, I'm going to force myself back into your narrative right now, but it just seems like there was like there's almost like turnovers of fans when you're a band like, you know, our bands and been around for a long time. And like, that was there like that new kind of cult of Ground Against Me that forms around that
I think
record?
That really started with Crime, where we would notice, like, when we would do a tour that there would be faces that we'd recognize that would be at multiple shows and that, like, you could tell, you know? So, like, it just only grew with the full length or whatever, and as we toured more, because, that record came out and immediately we're like, okay, let's go on tour. And our bass player at the time, Dustin, who I, like, grew up in bands with or whatever, he quit to go back to college. Mm-hmm. But it was like we knew it was coming. So it was like we did our last tour with him, and then we're like, okay, fuck, what do we do? Like, let's find a bass player. So that was when Andrew came into the picture.
And I guess subsequently, have you met Axl Rose?
No, I met like Slash, I've met Duff, yeah. I've met Matt Sorum, but
never Axl.
Never Axl. Yeah. I saw them play like that, whatever version of Guns N' Roses at Reading and Leeds in like 2010 or whatever. Yeah. It was terrible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, not necessarily. And I even like use your Illusions Volume 1 too. So
it would have been one solid record. You know, they just like there's no need to have that many Paul McCartney songs on Guns N' Roses record.
A couple ballad cuts on that one.
I mean, it just got ridiculous. But
has your opinion on Axl Rose changed having been in? Like, I think I find I have a lot more sympathy for people in bands that, as a younger punk, I was just like, fuck that band.
Totally, totally. I mean, well, just like the level of like attention that he got, and like how weird I'm sure fans are with him. You know, like you end up isolating yourself because you have to. Yeah. You know, like so I totally get that. Although I could like talk shit on Guns N' Roses all day, like or the current version, and get really into that. But that's like a whole podcast. And it's, you know.
Well, if you want to come back for part two, that's the GNR. We'll go deep.
Okay, I can really break it down. I've read like all the books. I like, you know, I know my stuff.
Well, that's for me too. Like I think everything you've brought up, I'm just like, I relate to so much because it's like I think being of the same age too. But like Guns N' Roses was that band. Like,
yeah.
Without them. Who knows?
Well, they were dangerous. Like, when I was 8 years old, I was like, holy shit, this band is, like, real. Especially compared to all those other bands at the time.
Yeah, like,
you know?
Poison and Motley
Crue. Oh, yeah, Warrant. Come on. You know, like...
Whitesnake. Like.
But that was... You know, that's the thing that pisses me off most about that current incarnation of Guns N' Roses, was it's like, okay, fine, replace the whole band, but, like... At least get the replacement members to dress cool.
Yeah.
Like, Guns N' Roses used to look fucking cool. Yeah. And these people look like they shopped at Hot Topic. You know? It doesn't look cool.
I know, but it's also that, you know, like you said, too, Duff McKagan, like, finding out, like, oh, Duff is in this band called The Farts, and then Alternative Tentacles reissued The Farts record. And I'm like, oh, this is, like, my gateway to that whole West Coast scene.
Well, that was before the internet, is how you discovered bands. Yep. It's like, okay, they're wearing that shirt, or, okay, they thanked this band in their liner notes, so, yeah, I'll check out Jughead's Revenge. What next, you know? Like,
so, I guess, when did you first meet Fat Mike, and
Well, with Fat, like, we put out that record, and we did an EP with No Idea, and then we had, like, done a tour with Hot Water Music, and really it started to grow, and I got, like, an email from Toby, who worked at Fat, and he was like, do you want to do one of the Fat records, 7-inch of the month?
Red Scare Records.
Yeah, yeah, of Red Scare. Yeah. And we were like, well, we just did this 7-inch. We don't really want to do a 7-inch. We want to do another full-length as our next thing. So I was like, well, would Fat do the next full-length? And he was like, well, let me talk to Mike. And so then, like, maybe 3 days later, Mike called on the phone. And, I was like, oh, my God, I'm talking to Fat Mike. Yeah. You know? Like, totally just, like, blown away that he likes my band and wants to put out the record. You know?
Because did you have any qualms about signing to Fat? Or was it not... an issue for
well me. It wasn't a signing thing.
Yeah, it wasn't,
you know,
a signing.
Like, that
exactly.
that was the thing, like, and that was like, you know, going back to Anti-Flag, is like they wanted us to sign a contract.
Yeah.
So we were like, no.
Well, was it a subsidiary of a major by that point, AF Records, or was
I'm
it
not
ever?
Sure, no. But it was like a 3-record contract.
Because they signed to Sony at a certain point, right?
Yeah, but that might have been after maybe. Yeah. I don't know. But so, like, you know, No Idea, Mike, like, they were both like, Mike was like, no contract, handshake deal, punk.
Oh yeah.
You know, so it was, there was no moral, like, you know, we weren't yet.
And I don't,
just like, okay, it's a punk that I grew up going to see play, and they want to put out our record.
Yeah, like, and obviously, I'm a huge Fat Records fan. It's defining my life and everything. But at the same time, I remember having a conversation with, I don't want to throw the member of this band under the bus, but someone in the band, The Observers, and they were like, oh, I was a big, huge Against Me fan, but now they signed a Fat. And it was almost like, you know, like at the time, you know, once again, in perspective, it's like, oh, but Fat is like the most straight-up label in the world, and is no band ever has a bad word to say about it, except for maybe Screeching Weasel, but they don't count, you know?
Yeah. So, and also, not to mention, it's like, I always felt at the time like, oh, did I like not disclose that I grew up listening to Fat bands? Yeah. Like, didn't you realize that about me? I know I like a lot of other punk bands that are maybe more hardcore, but like, you know, second show I ever went to or something. Yeah. You know? Like, it didn't make sense to us because we recognized the lineage and recognized where the desire came from in not an opportunistic way, of more of just a like, holy shit, Fat Records wants to work with us, you know? So
I guess as as a younger person, I'm saying this as being that person, you find your ownership over a band where you just can't see why they would not make the exact same choice that you make for them in your imagination.
Yeah, totally. Well, but you see it in different ways too, because like I always understood that, but then I like understood the other side of it of like, okay, like realistically, if we would have stayed on No Idea Records, we'd have been dead. Mm-hmm. You know, like mm-hmm. we would have never done anything more than we probably would have put out like one or two more records, and then interest would have died away,
yeah.
you know, and then like it just would have fizzled. Same with staying on Fat eventually. It was like, I was always of the mentality that you have to keep moving and keep doing different things just in order to challenge yourself, to make it interesting, to not become complacent, and to have as many experiences as you can with your band, because you don't know how long it'll last and mm-hmm. you don't know what'll happen next.
So at this point, did you see, like, I guess you started doing a lot bigger tours too, right? When did the Fat Record come?
Well, Anti-Flag took us on tour. It was like the Death of a Nation tour, where it was Anti-Flag, Rise Against, Us, and None More Black, and then a different AF Records band. And that was like 3 months long.
Wow.
So we did that tour.
America or North America, I should
say? It came to, yeah.
I know, I think I saw that show mm-hmm. in Toronto at the Opera House.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It was it the Dopamines was the AF Record band? No, it was like, Jughead from Screeching Weasel's band, wasn't it?
I'm not sure. Again, it like every week So it was a change. Different okay, AF yeah, Records yeah. band. But that was like our first real tour with like Laminates,
yeah.
you know, and everything like that. And then after that, we just like kept going, because mm-hmm. we got like a booking agent as that tour happened. And then like real tours started coming in, and it was like immediate major label in interest after that. So
and so was Sire the first one they talked? No, obviously probably not. Right?
No, the first, I mean, really like first time around, it was Universal. But it was like first, after we put out As the Eternal Cowboy, we were courted by every single major label, and we were given $1 million record deals,
wow.
or like offers by every major label, like Virgin, Sony, Universal, and Warner, all offered.
What's it like to be in that position?
It was crazy. You know, like, because yeah. I was like, you know, again, coming from having listened to the Sex Pistols, I was like, great rock and roll swindle.
Yeah.
Here we are.
Yeah.
This is our chance to do that
yeah.
for real. So, like, we would just, like, anytime they were like, do you want to be flown to this place and be taken out to these extravagant dinners and come and raid our CD cabinets? We're like, yes. And we would go and, like, order the most ridiculous shit. We'd take all their CDs from their CD cabinets and then go sell the CDs yeah. immediately. And it was just like, we just wanted to have fun with it. We even like, when they first coming in, offers first started coming in, we had Toby pose as our lawyer and take calls with the record labels. You know, we were just like, let's fuck with them. And then we had our friend Jake come on tour with us and make a documentary around it with the idea of just fucking with major labels.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Was there ever a point at that point were you thinking at that point that ultimately I'm going to pick one of these?
No, we had no intention at first.
Yeah.
You know, because we were really still of that, like, you know, it was still the punk rock thing. And then there was like a couple things that were like really eye-opening that like kind of changed my perspective on that stuff. And, you know, a lot of it had to do with realizing more and more that it was like, because my biggest thing was like the capitalist argument, you know, being anti-capitalist and feeling like you don't want capitalism in punk rock. But then ultimately realizing that a record label is a record label is a record label, and that small capitalism isn't any better than big capitalism. Is if someone's making a buck off of it, it's just about ethics and mm-hmm. who's doing it right and who's doing it fair. But, and then there was another incident too, like where we got so much shit because of Fat Records, you know, from like getting our tires slashed to like people physically attacking us to like
really
Max. Oh yeah, totally. Yeah, like
this is just before the major label stuff.
Yeah,
that stuff. I remember hearing about
stuff.
The major label.
We
stuff
played
afterwards.
A Polish American hall on Long Island that was set up by a 16-year-old fan of the band who charged $8 at the door, and people were physically stopping us from playing our instruments and then slashed our van tires after the show. And then the same kid who slashed our van tires after that show, we played a free show in Brooklyn not long after that. And he came and he like threw stink bombs on stage, and then there was like a fight that was about to happen outside after the show, and it was stupid. You know, it didn't look pretty or anything like that, but like we're all like bowing up on each other standing there, and I looked over and there was one of his friends, a punk, who picks up a brick, and I was like, wow, like this kid will fucking smash my head in because we're on Fat, you know, but we're also supposed to be punks here, like this is just fucked. Fuck
yeah.
This fuck this scene, fuck all of you, you know. And that just really like, then it became like, oh, if this decision will piss off punks, let's do it.
Yeah.
You know, like.
Yeah. And Wow, that's an insane dragon. And it's over a band being on a label.
Mm-hmm. And it's a fair label. It's a fair label. The most fair upfront label we've ever worked with.
I have been, now that I've been doing this for a long time, I have been, you know, in some label situations where I look back on it, I'm like, that wasn't a good situation. You never hear anyone say that about Fat. You never hear anyone say that about No Idea either. Mm-hmm. Like, that's like a situation where a lot of people are like still doing records with them years later. And so it just, yeah, like, it's funny what you don't understand necessarily from looking at the outside of situations versus later on.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So at that point, do you kind of call back some of these labels and you're like, yo?
No. Well, we thought surely giving them a run around, yeah, and then putting, yeah, out a documentary, like, we're obviously fucking with them that this after this next record there'll be no interest. But it was like they came back like double hard, you know, like they were just really pursuing it. So at that point, you know, I kind of felt like, and I don't mean this in a talking shit way at all, but it was like Fat Mike didn't like searching for a former clarity, and he was very vocal about
he said that
with us, you know, like, and so at that point then it was like, okay, well, you know, like, people always have this illusion, like, that you work with a major label and they start trying to creatively control you. But really, it's the same on any label. Yeah. And that if you're working with someone, they're going to have their opinions and, yeah, they're going to tell you their opinions. It's just as to whether or not you want to listen to that. So fuck it, mm-hmm, you know? Mm-hmm. And then, like, when the major labels came back around again, it was just like, okay, well, this is stupid. You know, like, this is probably not going to happen a third time. And, you know, we had been touring so much that, like, more and more and more, like, the interpersonal relationships within the band were just falling apart. Mm-hmm. So it was like, if we do this, it'll be another step that will require us to continue as a band and, like, make it work still. So yeah, it was just like, yeah, let's do it. And Sire, like, was Sire. So,
well, yeah, did you meet Seymour Stein?
Seymour Stein was really involved, and he would, like, I mean, the dude was, like, 80 years old, yeah, then, and he was like coming out and he would sit on stage the whole time and watch our shows and be like, that was great, you know, like, so we're like, holy fuck, Seymour Stein, the real Seymour Stein.
Yeah, the real,
like,
Seymour Stein.
But they were cool, you know.
Yeah. So do you look back on that and you're like, are you happy with that experience being on the major and everything like that? Obviously it, yeah, helped the band get to another level and things like that.
It's, you know, it's weird, it's really weird, like, when you have, like, perspective to look back on stuff, on what bugs you and what doesn't bug you. Because, like, that first record we did with Sire was the best experience. Where, yeah, they're really excited about the band, yeah, you know. We got to work with Butch Vig, which was, like, ultimately made the decision of signing to a major label alone worth it. It was just the chance to make two records with him. But after that first record, like, I knew it. I wasn't stupid. I was like, look, when we got the contract, I was like, it needs to be a two firm record deal. Like, they need to be guaranteed they'll do a second record, because there's no way our first record is going to go gold or, yeah, platinum. Yeah. And if you don't go gold or platinum, there's no way the fucking label is going to care about, yeah, the second record, yeah, you know? So, like, I just knew, you know, like, that was going to be the case. And then there ended up being a lot of, like, critical acclaim, like Spin named the record album of the year or, yeah, whatever, but that didn't translate into sales. It just did, like, a little bit better than our previous records, mm-hmm, done, which was still great by our standards, you know? Like, but so that first record was a great time. The second record was still a good time. There was, like, extenuating circumstances on around our band that made it miserable, and the label was falling apart. But it was still like, okay, we're making another record with Butch. This, yeah, is great, you know? Like,
well, and Butch Vig, like, you know, I love those records. I think they stand up. But people, like, a lot of people, once again, like, this next wave of fans will be like, oh, the sound changed when Butch Vig came in. He polished it too much and things like that. Do you look back on those records and you think they say, I think they hold up great. I love his production.
Right. Well,
too.
But like, that was me. That, yeah, wasn't Butch so, yeah, much. Like, yeah, so our first record was definitely, like, a more, you know, more organic, if you want to put it like that, approach to, yeah, recording a record, you know, like, it took longer, but it wasn't that different from, like, the record we did with Jay Robbins or, mm-hmm, whatever. Mm-hmm. The second record, knowing that it was like, okay, well, we're certainly going to get dropped after this record, you know, and it probably won't, there's no way it's going to do, like, it won't do any better than the previous record or whatever. So, like, what is the most I can get out of this opportunity right now? I'm working with someone who's made some of my favorite records of all time. Like, if there's a technique that you know recording, I want to learn it now.
Yeah.
So the only way I can learn that is if we use my record or our record, mm-hmm, to do that. Mm-hmm. So, like, sure, show me how to fucking use Melodyne on vocals. Let's fucking, like, I want to know every single thing so that I can use that after the fact, because that's more valuable than any other fucking peripheral bullshit, you know?
Do you think that, like, that was that experience essential to kind of become the producer?
Yeah, with that intention, and then with the next record of being like, okay, now let's do our own studio, and now, like, because the first time you go into a studio, like, I didn't know how a fucking compressor worked, you know? Like, I didn't understand anything.
I still don't.
Right, me neither, actually, but, like, I know what they look like.
Yeah, that puts you one ahead of me, because I still don't know what they look like.
But, so, like, yeah, I mean, it was like, each record you made, you got a little more comfortable in the studio. But just that opportunity was so, like, you know, in depth, and, like, you're working in these studios that you could never otherwise afford, that you're just like, let's take advantage of this and get the most out of it and not have a negative attitude, but have a positive attitude with it.
Yeah, it's like the best on-the-job experience you could hope for, and you're being paid to do it, more or less, because you're recording. So with, like, leaving that situation, was the intention, like, let's start our own thing? Or was it...
Well, I, you know, like, that was the other thing about the way it ended then, too, like... Warner Side was ultimately cool in that, like, they gave us White Crosses. They gave us ownership of the masters, all artwork related to it, all videos. And fuck, they spent, like, over $500,000 on that record. So they're just like, here, have it. They didn't give us New Wave, which is a whole other story, and I'm still a little feeling burned about that, especially about the repress that just happened, which we had no involvement in, and no one even gave us a free copy of.
You didn't get copies.
No. But anyways, so...
Well, it's nice to know that the major label's, like, living up to the reputation after the fact.
Yeah, but it's an indie label doing it. Anyway. But anyway, so, like... yeah, I mean, coming out of that, it was like, again, like, I'm really a self-aware person, and I know what's, I realize what's going on, and it was like, okay, well, we just did our two records with the major label, what are our options? Epitaph, like, or, like, any other label, but any other label is going to be perceived as, like, a step back, or, like, you, okay, and that's where they're going to die, or something like that. And at the time, too, I could tell, like, nobody wanted anything to do with us. They, like, we had a stink on us. So it was just like, fuck this. Like, I know our worth. Like, we'll do it on our own. Because we've done that before. And now I even have more knowledge because I just made two fucking records with Butch. Like, screw you all.
Is making a concept record, do you find it different than making another record?
You know, no.
Because people, like, always ask me that, too. So I was,
it's like, always a concept for me.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's always like, what theme am I writing under? Because you're looking at the record.
New Wave was a concept record too, right? Like,
to some extent, I mean, it was, the concept was like, we're signing to a major.
I've always actually wanted to ask you, the artwork for that, was that, how involved was that during the process? Because there was, like, prints done for every song, right? Or there's, like, some sort of...
Oh, yeah, yeah. That, which wasn't the original idea, but just happened after
it happened
with Chris
after
Norris. Like, yeah.
Okay.
But, I mean, that, like, the Odyssey for that album's artwork was, like, I used to, just from zine days, would always do, like, X-Acto knife, like, cutouts and stencils and stuff. So that image I had just been doing as, like, almost like a doodle in the studio. So we originally had a cover shoot that the photographer who did, like, a couple Modest Mouse records did, and that was, like, going to be the cover art, and the photos came back, and we were like, oh, fuck, these are not cool.
Oh, like, it was supposed to be you guys on the cover?
No, it wasn't us. It was, like, of other things.
Oh, okay, okay.
And the main problem was that it was, like, we didn't take into account that he was taking photos in winter and that it was going to be a summer release. So we're like, everyone looks cold in these photos, and the record is coming out in, like, June, all right? So we can't do this, you know?
You need a song in the summer. That's the one hope you have with that major.
They're wearing scarves on the cover.
And so, actually, artwork-wise, too, has that always been something that's been important?
Yeah, you know,
it was always,
like
a defined aesthetic, it seemed.
It was originally, to me, I always wanted to do all the album artwork, and it was became something that I eventually realized, like, I had to release some control on, but still I'm always stoked whenever I have a chance to do anything like that.
Do you still do art for yourself type thing, or?
Just, like...
doodle and
not for like any release purposes or anything, but I don't have any drawing skills. It's more just like collage work and like that old cut and paste style zine work.
Yeah, like the Winston Smith, what's his name, the guy who did all the Dead Kennedys. Melanie, what's his name, the guy who did the Dead Kennedys collage art, do you remember?
It's Wes, isn't it?
Is it Wes Smith?
I think it's Winston, actually.
I think it's Winston, right? Winston Smith. Okay, good, okay. Yeah.
Or like G from Crass.
Yeah, or G from Crass.
That was obviously my biggest influence.
Yeah, yeah. I guess I went with the color one because I can't handle black and white. I need to colorize. Well, I could go on forever, but I want to have you on for a part two, and you've got a full day to prepare for a show.
Right on.
So thank you so much for doing this.
Yeah, my pleasure. This is fun. Yeah.
Will you come back for a part two?
Oh, I mean, hell yeah.
Guns and Roses.
Yeah, totally.
For an hour next time.
Yeah, you got to read both the Duff and the Slash book.
I've read the Duff book.
Cool. The Slash book is more real. The Duff book's all like, and then we all lived happily ever after and never did drugs again, which you just know is bullshit. So.
I got to say, though, we did that. Well, I think, has Against Me done Soundwave in Australia?
We did Big Day Out.
Okay. We did Soundwave, and he was on Soundwave, and like I saw his trailer open to Crack the first day, and I grabbed Jonah, our drummer, who's the other hardcore nerd in the band, and so I went over there, and I'm just like, we're going to go talk to Duff, and I just knock on the door, and I'm like, hello, Duff McKagan, my name is Damien Abraham, I play in a band called Fucked Up, let's talk about Fastbacks. And he's just like, whoa.
But he's cool. He
super cool.
Yeah.
Awesome.
I will say though, like, we did, like, the first time I met them or saw them or whatever in person was like this LA radio festival, and it was Velvet Revolver.
Okay.
And like, seeing them, it was just like, those are rock stars.
Yeah.
Like, they still have this like aura around them where you're like even like Duff put on like a JanSport backpack when he was leaving, and I'm like, oh my god, he wears a JanSport backpack. Yeah. Like, he's so normal.
He's like, just like us. I know exactly what you're saying. Like, I met Perry Farrell one time, and he had that aura too, where you're like, oh, that's why Jane's Addiction is like that band,
because
you've got that aura.
It's this thing. It's like magic.
I'm going to find that aura one day. Well, thank you for sharing your aura with me, Laura.
Right on.
I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.